evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, June 26, 2019. South Sudanese lawmakers are unable to resolve a standoff over the budget.
First time in the history of this August House to be able to look at issues that are dealing with the citizens and trying to do their work for which they were sent into the parliament.
And a South Sudanese construction company wins a $1 billion contract to build a modern university in Bor.
We are really ready to take off, and within 3 months, we are going to be on the ground physically to make sure that this university starts, and we are ready to complete within 2 years.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A standoff between lawmakers and the Speaker of South Sudan's Transitional Legislative Assembly remains unresolved and threatens to hamper business in the legislation. After meeting for 2 days, the lawmakers failed to come with an agreement. The stalemate began last week when lawmakers booed Finance Minister Salvatore Garang and blocked him from presenting his budget proposals for the 2019-2020 fiscal year until he pays civil servants' salaries. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Finance Minister Garang was supposed to present his budget proposals during last week's parliament session, but several MPs blocked his presentation, demanding instead that the finance minister first pay state and national security officers and civil servants who have not received their salaries in 6 months. Lawmakers from the ruling SPLM party caucus met for the past 2 days to try to resolve the impasse, but no agreement was reached. Madeleine Peter is a lawmaker representing Central Equatoria from the SPLM caucus.
They came up with two resolutions only. First, they said they are not against the budget. And second, they said the salaries of the civil servants should be paid first, including that of the army. After that, the budget will be tabled.
Abraham Kuol Nyon, Associate Political Science Professor at the University of Juba, says the lawmakers are using the standoff as bait for bribes from the Kiir administration, which would like to see the budget passed as soon as possible.
This is mostly the first time in the history of this August House to be able to look at issues that are dealing with the citizens and trying to do their work for which they were sent into the parliament. Okay? And in that case, the citizens will be able to say, yes, I think the MPs are with us. But from other hand, there is going to be another problem that other doubting citizens will be able to say, look here, these MPs are not only fighting for the interest of the civil servant or for the interest of the country, but they are just trying to fight for their own interest so that the government will be able to give them more allowance and give them more tips so that they will be able to do their work.
Nyon says the MPs should not only be demanding salary payments for civil servants, but also compel the Kiir administration to produce budgets that deliver basic services to ordinary citizens.
And this is where there is going to be a very big problem. You know, the executive are only interested in passing the budget in the paper. But it is good always to pass a physical budget, because the context of South Sudan has been that the government always has been passing budget in the papers that is not always implemented.
Paul says the lawmakers should be able to convince the citizens that the government respects their demands for services without any strings attached.
When the MPs were looking for their increment into their salaries, the chief will by then say this is not a good practice. That is what led on to the 40,000, okay, that was given to them as a way of teaching them and be able to make the policies of the government to be implemented.
Kuol blames the government for presenting unrealistic fiscal budgets that he says will not help improve the economy or deliver the required services to the people. Information Minister Michael Makuei told reporters after a cabinet meeting last Friday that the MPs should have first listened to the finance minister's budget presentation, saying the proposals provide answers on how to improve the economy and how to pay for civil servant salaries in arrears. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still on money matters, the South Sudan government has awarded a $1 billion contract to a South Sudanese company known as Intertaco to construct the Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology in the Jonglei State Capital, Bor. Dengai Deng has this report for VOA from Bor.
Intertaco Managing Director Alima Florence says President Salva Kiir's office recently signed a contract with our company to construct the new university in Bor, bearing the name of South Sudan's founder, Dr. John Garang. Florence says construction will begin soon.
We are really ready to take off, and within 3 months, we are going to be on the ground physically to make sure that this university starts, and we are ready to complete within 2 years.
Florence says the office of the president signed a $1 billion contract to complete construction of the university.
All the university will be equipped by this project and then to bring every requirement.
When contacted to confirm whether or not the president office awarded the contract, presidential spokesman Ateng Wek Ateng had this to say.
I have no idea. I'm just coming from the village.
The academic registrar for Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology, Dr. Coach Ruben, says he appreciates the initiative taken by the office of the president.
The university, by the way, is facing a lot of challenges. It's starting from the lectures hall and all the structure of the university is really very, very, very down, and it's not the real structures that's supposed to be for the university. And now, based on the records, it's going to be a very wonderful university, very wonderful construction, and everything is going to be there for this university.
Robin says it will be a school of higher learning, not just for South Sudanese. Agot Alier, the deputy governor of Jonglei State, says if constructed as shown in a video to officials, the University of Dr. John Garang will be a tremendous benefit to the South Sudanese people.
We very much appreciate the president for the offer he has given to the people of this state, and of course in extension to the people of South Sudan, by honoring the University of Dr. John Garang for Science and Technology.
Aliera assured state officials that Intertoco Construction Company will carry out their work in a conducive environment.
Will not allow anybody to interfere with whatever the work the company will be doing here to accomplish this very magnificent type of project here.
There is little information available for Intertoco and its financial backers. Alier says the Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology will provide high-quality education service and also will provide jobs for the local people. For VOA News, I am Dengai Deng, reporting from Bor.
The United Nations investigator says the rise of private surveillance industry and the targeting of individuals by digital surveillance technology is undermining freedom of expression and putting the lives of many individuals at risk. The UN Special Rapporteur on Freedom of Opinion and Expression, David Kaye, submitted his report to the UN Human Rights Council on Wednesday. Lisa Schrein reports for VOA from the Council in Geneva.
UN investigator David Kaye does not condemn all surveillance activities. He recognizes that governments may have a valid and critical need to use surveillance technology to confront criminal activity such as terrorism. He says governments should be able to acquire and use the technology to protect their citizens. But he says he finds the transfer of private digital surveillance technology to governments that use it as a tool of repression very worrisome.
We are witnessing a surveillance free-for-all in which states and industry are essentially collaborating in the spread of technology that is causing immediate and regular harm to individuals worldwide, often across borders, harming individuals and organizations that are essential to democratic life, journalists, defenders, opposition figures, lawyers, and others.
In his report, Kay cites numerous examples. In one case, Ethiopia's government allegedly spied on an Ethiopian-born man in the U.S. The technology infected his computer with malware marketed by a German and British company. The program recorded his emails, internet video calls, and keystrokes. The data was then sent back to servers in Ethiopia. In another case, Kay says credible reporting suggests the Chinese government used facial recognition technology and surveillance cameras to look for ethnic Uyghurs based on their appearance. The government reportedly keeps records of their comings and goings for search and review. He says some of the technology was produced by private Chinese companies. Kay says the technologies are spreading globally without control. He says the private surveillance industry operates in the shadows, developing and marketing the technologies in highly secretive settings. He notes that trade is driven by a thirst for profits. He warns the failure of states to impose constraints on the export or other transfer of targeted surveillance technology allows the illegitimate, dangerous trade to flourish.
There's wide recognition that digital surveillance, particularly when conducted in the absence of legal constraint and oversight, under cover of secret laws or policies, without disclosure of purchase or use, is a threat to freedom of expression.
Kay is calling for an immediate moratorium on the global sale, transfer, and use of the tools of the private surveillance industry. He says he's not calling for a permanent ban or an end to all surveillance, but he says rigorous human rights safeguards must be put in place to assure digital surveillance tools are being used in legitimate ways before business in the technology is allowed to go ahead. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, is the civil society free in South Sudan? We'll bring an answer right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite celebration food?
I can say it's pounded yam. Pounded yam is being made out of yam. They pound it and it becomes thin like semo. So that is pounded yam.
Al kubus is a kind of steamed bread, I can say, made of flour or wheat flour with stew, vegetable soup, and you can even eat it raw. It tastes great.
My favorite food is komonia. Whenever I go in a certain celebration, that's what I like eating. It's a kind of meat made out of many things indeed, but it's so delicious, so that's why I like it.
I like jollof with dried fish with beef. I like it a lot because anytime I take it, makes me very, very happy.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The space for civic engagement is shrinking every day in South Sudan. That's the view of panelists at a recent discussion on the future of South Sudan held at the United States Institute of Peace here in Washington. Civil society activist Emily Koiti says the role of civil society and the question of accountability in South Sudan is key to finding a lasting solution to the conflict in the country.
Mention what the civil society needs. Partners should be able to engage all civil society who are now in form of organizations, civil organizations, but also in the advent of the RSS in form of coalitions, to ask them what flexible support in the context of the RSS would look like for us to be able to envision the kind of success that we all want to see in the days of the transition period. I think that would be very, very important. Besides everything else, because we know that government is not going to provide civil society with their support, and civil society is looking out to partners to assist them, and yet they could give so much mileage to the whole process if only they are supported.
Thanks, Dr. Emily. I'm going to go down the line here with quick interventions, Brian.
For the South Sudan that we want to exist, some of the things that need to happen right now is reform of the institutions of accountability. We've seen constantly that the government has been on the path of basically looting public coffers. So we need a reform of the institutions of accountability. These institutions right now have been captured by the state. So what we have in South Sudan is actually a kleptocracy. So to reform these institutions, what needs to happen is we need to empower them in terms of how the leadership of these institutions are appointed. Right now, what happens is that it's cronies and people close to the system that are appointed for the purpose to enhance the looting of state coffers, to make them look the other way. So we need the legislation to be improved on that. And we also need these institutions to be resourced. So far, what we have seen is that, for instance, take the National Audit Chamber. According to the Constitution, the National Audit Chamber is supposed to audit the accounts of government every year and make those accounts public. That has not happened since 2012. The reason that we got to learn on that is that the audit chamber did not have the resources. Turns out that the audit chamber had the resources to actually conduct audits, but someone in government didn't want the audit to be made public because it made the government look bad. And so from this stance, holding the government accountable for the spending of public money is going to be impossible. Institutions need to be reformed and strengthened. The National Audit Chamber, the Public Accounts Committee in the National Legislature, the Anti-Corruption Commission needs to be empowered to do its job.
I would agree with all of the things that civil society borders are going to be supremely important and affect everything else. Institutional reform needs to happen. I think I would add, in terms of if we're thinking long-term, next 5 to 10 years, we need to be thinking now about what the elections are going to look like at the end of this agreement. I think sort of one of the worst things that could happen is we get to the end of this and we have non-democratic elections, and it just throws us into sort of the same old cycle. And I think international support is going to be critical to making sure that those elections are democratic, that everyone has a chance to vote. And it's going to take a while to get the infrastructure in place to be able to carry out those elections. So we need to be thinking about it early.
I think there's a really good point on the elections. We often forget that is meant to be the off-ramp to the peace agreement. We also often forget that is what sparked this violence in the first place. And so I would argue in my moderator prerogative that the risk is less about non-democratic elections. The risk is about how do you manage the competition for who carries the flag. And I think that's something that we haven't even started to put on the table for the SPLM flag.
I agree with everything they mentioned. But I will also just want to add that so one of the things that I really don't want to lose sight is the accountability for atrocities that were committed, because myself, I lost my mother in 2013, and I have been willing to first advocate for peace and end to the violence, knowing that those who committed the atrocities will still be held accountable, for their crime. And for doing that, I do think it will serve as a deterrent. So when we get to the election, somebody might think twice, because the situation in South Sudan continues to get worse because we put out these, through UN and international community, these sanctioned individual targeted sanctions, but they have no mechanism to make it stick. So until we make some individual pay for what they have done, it is just another, a crime or another, person name that has been put in the UN sanction. So I really want to make sure that we don't lose sight with this idea of accountability for atrocities. At the same time, we also need to find ways, as we focus on civil society and putting resources to develop civil society leadership skills, that is also has to be a way to find how to marriage the diaspora and the civil society back on the ground. Because one of the things that all of you might be aware of is that social media, particularly Facebook, in other parts of the world, it is used for holding government accountable, for organizing rallies like what we saw in Hong Kong over the weekend. But in the context of South Sudan, social media, particularly Facebook, has been very divisive. You have South Sudanese going on social media for 4 or 5 hours, and what they are saying in that, and Brian can attest to this, is that they are just lashing out at the other tribe or to the other, you know, political opposition that they disagree with. So as South Sudanese in the next 5 years going forward, we need to find ways, you know, to break those barriers and on how to use social media, because social media can be used in a positive way rather than the way it has been used in a negative way. So I also really think that the United States and partners need to focus on high-level diplomatic efforts. One of the guarantors for the agreement, which is Bashir, is no longer there. And so now the only guarantor is Museveni. And how do we trust that he's going to be an honest breaker?
So that bridges perfectly to my last question, actually, because you can't have a conversation in the United States without asking what should the United States be doing to help to get South Sudan on a path towards peace. And as you all know, there's been a lot of criticism about what's perceived as the lack of support by the United States. I think that does not acknowledge the nearly $1 billion of assistance in humanitarian aid that keeps South Sudanese alive, and whose food security and fundamental protection is threatened by the civil war itself. But I'd like to ask panelists to think through what should be prioritized, whether it's diplomatic assistance. And, of course, the United States isn't just the administration. It includes the Congress. It includes other institutions. It includes a role that South Sudanese Americans can play. So what should be the priorities in action? Maybe I'll turn to Mark first for this one.
Because you already know my answer. So I think, you know, you're mentioning how much the U.S. is spending now with USAID, especially, there's a convening power there based on the amount of money. And there's an opportunity for the U.S. administration or Congress or whatever comes together to be the convener of all these financial institutions. And that's because the IMF, the U.S. is the largest contributor, African Development Bank, the U.S. is a donor, all these huge institutions, which the South Sudanese government is going to turn to or already has turned to for financial assistance, the U.S. has a foot in almost all of them. Maybe not in terms of China's Development Bank or a couple others. But in any case, the U.S. has the ability to bring all these people together and say, we have to have a firm and very clear way in which financial assistance is distributed in this country. Because I think over time and over a long conflict, there's been an ability of South Sudanese partners as well as international partners to kind of choose the assistance they'd like to deliver, or which. And I'm not talking about humanitarian assistance here either. I'm talking about development and financial assistance for kind of stabilizing or capitalizing their economy. And with U.S. leadership, I think there's an opportunity there because also, again, it's not putting the U.S. in an uncomfortable spot of feeling like they might get burned again if there's ability to bring these people around the table.
Brian, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think, you know, my personal opinion here, I think that there needs to be a modicum of U.S. involvement with the political system in South Sudan. We saw in the run-up to the crisis in December 2013 an unfolding of the liberal state-building process in South Sudan. There was a lot of focus on the technical aspects of, say, transforming the army, helping, you know, on that front. But then the international community totally overlooked the political side, the brewing contest for control of the state by the rival factions in the ruling party. So despite high-level people coming from South Sudan to D.C. to say, hey, stuff is going to happen, which is going to be really, really bad, and we need someone to step in, that process was overlooked. And so it should not repeat itself this time around for other reasons too, even for the national security interests of the U.S. If you look at the national security policy or strategy of the Trump administration, it states very clearly that instability in East and Central Africa poses a threat to the U.S. And its allies. And so when you have instability in a country that is basically a ward of the United States, and I think that brings in another problem because it compromises that intention in the national security strategy. And therefore, if the United States recedes completely from involvement in the political process in South Sudan, I think that creates an opportunity for other malign powers to get involved. And that, in the long term, I don't think is conducive or good for the interests of the United States.
Thanks, Brian. Morgan?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with what my colleague said. I think there's a need for some high-level pressure on the parties, as we mentioned, in order to push them to actually implement the agreement. I think what you said about the sort of citizens being the guarantors of the agreement is real, but they need our support to be able to do that. So we need to continue to support them. And I don't think it went unnoticed that the United States didn't sign, and that was a little bit of a blow that the U.S. might not be there to help the citizens to hold their leaders accountable. As was mentioned, I think everyone's watching very closely what's happening in Sudan, and they're worried about Bashir being gone and not being a guarantor anymore, and what that does to the power balance between Museveni and Bashir holding the leaders accountable. So I think there's a lot up in the air. China's obviously moving in. I think it'll be important to continue sort of making our voice heard and that we care.
Some people have argued that we should start to talk differently about the political leadership in the country and talk about them as the political class, and reserve the term leadership for the people who are truly showing leadership towards peace. And that's, you know, that's how we use words, but maybe that starts to matter, because we also consistently hear a sense of betrayal, a lack of confidence, a lack of trust between the United States and South Sudanese political leaders. But I don't think, I'm concerned that that's also impacting on the relationship with the people who share the values, the principles, and the ideas that the United States has always supported in South Sudan and are central.
Those panelists, David Chart, founder of the Council on South Sudan American Relations, Morgan Simpson, Deputy Director of Democracy International, Emily Koiti, a civil society activist, Mark Ferrello, Senior Advisor with the Sentry, and Brian Adeba, Deputy Director of Policy at the Enough Project. Susan Stegand, Director for Africa Programs at the Institute, moderated the discussions. In part four of this discussion tomorrow, panelists talk about the role of the U.S. government in efforts to end the violence in South Sudan. That's our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Longonyo by Colonel Mido from Yei River State.
Sabi Guru shuta kide ma bodita fisa mae Saidu masakine Saidu akwana kulue Saidu masakine Saidu akwana kulue Guru shuta kide ma bido funita ya sabi Taki de mabodita fisa mae Saidu masakine Saidu akwana kulue Saidu masakine Hey yakwana Aino takumlo kuluku Makalam gurush rasto biga kebir Makalam gurush biga mabisele munasisika Aba halkulu
We have been listening to Colonel Mido with the song Longonyo. I am John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Gurushu mabido funita. Eta bisibu gurush de kulu fi dunia. Nina kulu sawa ya kwana taye. Nina kulu sawa ya kwana taye. Kanita patroe waleta longonyo. Kanita longonyo e wale jata kiseredia. Nina kurusawa e ya kwanata e. Nina kurusawa.